Yeah, I basically confronted him and said, yo, did you stab those kids?
And what was his response?
F***ed up, bro.
You're hearing just some of the very long testimonials that happen in court the most recent day for Raul Valley, who is accused of murder, stabbing another teen to death at a Shelton party back in May of 2022, as well as stabbing three other teens that night. They did survive. But you just heard testimonial specifically from one of the defendant's friends at the time, a witness who got an immunity deal in exchange for his testimony. This is now the second person in this case to get one of these immunity deals. We heard from now two former friends of the defendant who were there that night, one of which had allegedly provided the weapon in this case. And now this witness, who also says he was with him and was, I don't want to say part of the violence, but certainly was in and amongst what had erupted earlier that evening and then transpired into what has now become the death of Jimmy McGrath. Joining us now to kind of weigh in on the conversation, Attorney Bill Bloss, who is our legal expert on the show. He is not involved in the case whatsoever, but I love his insight and perspective on it. Bill, welcome back. I want to talk about immunity deals, because this seems to be the biggest thing that people are upset about, and kind of understandably so. You have two other, at the time, teenagers who were there on the scene, one of which allegedly provided the murder weapon, and they essentially get off scot-free. How does that work?
Well, so it really boils down to what the prosecutor thinks is more important. Is it more important that I get the testimony from the person saying that I got the knife and I gave it to him at his request, at Valley's request? Or is it more important to hold that person accountable for actually providing the weapon? Because, you know, if the weapon hadn't been provided, does the whole thing happen? Maybe it doesn't, right? And we don't know. But it's evidence that I'm sure the prosecutor thought very hard about. Do I want to give immunity to the person who provided the weapon, or is it more important for me to get that testimony? Because the testimony is important. It obviously shows deliberation. It shows that this wasn't like a completely spur of the moment event. There was some degree of, I mean, I don't want to say thought exactly, but it wasn't instantaneous. So that's probably why the prosecutor thought it was so important.
Well, and when you think about it, too, Attorney Bloss, and I'm not saying I'm for or against these types of immunity deals, but sort of to your point, the defendant is alive. I mean, like, I think about situations like I hate to even compare the two, but, you know, like a Dulo situation, one of the biggest reasons there, I think, was so much pressure and you couldn't really do an immunity deal was because the lead suspect is not with us anymore. So, I don't know if that's also a reason why. I mean, I think you can tell somebody where your knife is in the car, but it's not like he put the knife into his hand and said, go do this. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. You know, when you talk about co-conspirator types of charges, it probably the testimonial meant more in this case to have the person who actually went through with the actions than the one who provided the weapon or at least suggested where to go to get it.
Well, sure. It's just the prosecutor's got to weigh the relative culpability of all of the actors and then say, well, you know, what's more important to me? Is it more important to me to get this testimony or is it more important for me to hold him accountable? Sure. If the person who got the knife out of the glove compartment said, here's your knife, go do what you have to do, then I think we're looking at something different.
Right.
That's a different level of culpability. But I guess the prosecutor felt that the knife was going to get produced anyway, and whether Valley was going to get it, whether one of the other kids was going to get it, this would have happened regardless. I'm speculating obviously, but I think that that's there certainly is not that the higher level of culpability like a co-conspirator to the murder. I think the evidence that I've heard anyway would fall very, very short of that. On the other, because there's no thought that there was going to be necessarily a murder. I mean, this could be just a defensive use of a knife, you know, like, get away from me, I've got a knife. That's obviously not what happened. So know, I think the prosecutors have to make tough decisions like this all the time, both with immunity and also with cooperating witnesses. Do I want to give a guy a break, you know, because of the person is testifying against somebody who I really need the person to testify against? That happens every day in our court. Sometimes it's pretty distasteful, honestly, because somebody with a pretty bad record and pretty bad conduct is being given a break because they're willing to testify against somebody else. On the other hand, sometimes the only way to get that somebody else convicted and off the streets is by a cooperating witness. So it's complicated, Melissa.
Yeah. Oh, no, it certainly is. And that's why I love getting your perspective. Attorney Bill Bloss, who, again, I just want to remind you, is our legal expert on the show. He's not involved in the case. He doesn't represent either side of it. But I do think he has, you know, a lot of experience, obviously. And I do love to get his insight when we're talking about these cases. A couple of things that have stood out to me, Bill, and I don't know your thoughts on it, so feel free to weigh in. Does it surprise you that the defense has not brought up a mental health evaluation of the defendant?
Well, not necessarily, because it depends on what it would show, right? And also, we're not in the defense's case yet. And so if the defense is going to present some kind of an extenuating circumstances kind of defense, that wouldn't have happened yet anyway. But honestly, unless it's an issue of competence, or unless it's an issue of a mental health situation that I haven't heard the evidence of yet. Mental health is more of an issue for sentencing than it is for guilt and innocence, with a few exceptions that I don't, again, I haven't seen it here, but we're not in the defense's case. It may be that that the defense is going to put on some kind of a self-defense emotional distress kind of defense. It certainly sounds like it was a very volatile situation. It was, you know, there were, 30 or 40 kids mm-hmm. surrounding their car, banging on it. Some windshield was broken. It was certainly tense. It was certainly, and I think there was, the defense is probably going to put on some evidence about, and already has through cross-examination, about how threatened they felt, the three boys, putting aside that they were there kind of at their choice and they left and came back and left and came back. That's kind of an unhelpful fact for the defense. But I think we may see that, Melissa, but it really may be more of an issue for sentencing.
I also find
that there is a conviction.
Yeah, right. And I think that's what I also find really surprising, Attorney Bloss, is the fact that we still don't even know what the defense is. Like, we don't know what their kind of counter argument is. Like, is it self-defense? Was it, you know, that he didn't provoke what had gone on? Like, it is interesting to me at this point, we don't know what they're going to counter. Or maybe it's not. Maybe it's not surprising.
Well, it's really not surprising, because the defense doesn't have to do anything. Under our system, the defendant is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. And if the defense believes that the prosecution has not proved its case, the defense may not put on a case and may say, look, they didn't prove some element of the offense, some element of the charge, or. They may believe that any kind of defense evidence would be so tenuous that they would lose credibility with the jury. That's possible. Mm. Or they may have a defense. And so, you know, I've tried criminal cases. I have thought going in the defense was going to be one thing, and then after the testimony of some of the prosecution witnesses, I said, you know what, that's not the defense. It's something we're going to go in a different direction here. And so that happens all the time. And whenever you go second in a case, you plan, but then you have to adjust your plans depending on what the evidence shows, especially in a criminal case. Remember, there's no discovery in criminal cases, and there's no depositions. There's no sitting down with witnesses and questioning them under oath like there is in a lawsuit. You're basically preparing a defense based on police reports, witness statements, interviews of any witnesses who will cooperate with you. But it's a very different very different proposition than a civil case.
We have attorney Bill Bloss here, our legal expert on the show, and we're talking about the Raul Valley case, which continues on this week. His trial, he is accused of stabbing and killing Jimmy McGrath, stabbing three other then teens back in May of 2022 outside of a home in Shelton during a party that was going on there. So, Attorney Bloss, I know you have nothing to do with this case, but I'd love to get your perspective on it. It's kind of hard. I don't know if you feel this way. It's really hard as someone, you know, from the outside looking in, that besides first responders and medical staff, every single person on the stand has been a young person, whether it's 19, 20, 21. They're very young. They're people who were at this party that night. And they clearly are forever impacted, forever changed, scarred, however you want to describe them, by that night. How much does that impact the jury in their decision on what to do with Raul Valley? Because, again, it's so, regardless of, I think, what comes out of their testimonials, I think that certainly has been hard to watch. Each one of these kids, I hate to call them kids, but kids at the time, get up and testify in such a gruesome case. How much does that have an impact on the jury, you think?
Well, look, this is a very emotional case, a very emotion-laden case. And I think when we talked last time, I talked about how it was a tragedy, both for the families of the victim, McGrath, but also the Valley family. You know, if he's convicted, he's facing quite a long term in jail, prison. But it also, you're right, it also affects everybody who is there, and particularly the people who are have to come up and testify. It's on TV. This is going to circulate around the internet forever. The jury, I think the jury is going to assess the testimony of these young people and recognize that they're just innocent bystanders. You know, they're just standing there. They didn't ask for this. And I haven't watched every minute of the trial. I've watched some of it, and you just can't watch it without feeling sadness.
Yeah,
I can't anyway. I mean, I don't know how other people feel, but it's just the whole. You know, I was struck by one of the girlfriend of Valley, Trafficante, Mackenzie Trafficante, I think, had maybe the most cogent piece of testimony, and that is she texted Valley, I guess, and said, you know, is this true? Did you do this? And she responded, you know, Lito, you've ruined everything. Literally, you've ruined everything. And that might have been the most cogent observation of any witness in the trial so far. For lots of people, most significantly, obviously, the McGrath family, but for lots of people, this event, this party, this fight, this killing ruined everything. And it's awful. You wish you could undo turn the clock back. You wish you could undo it, and people make better decisions. But this is an example, Melissa, of how a series of small decisions has a ripple effect across the pond that changes the lives of dozens of people. Mm-hmm. And it's awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it truly is tragic. And again, I know they had said that it would take about 2 weeks for the case to wrap up. So, I mean, we're kind of at that 2 week mark this week. So we'll see what happens.
They'll finish this week. There is. And remember, we don't have court on Friday. So I would guess that they don't want to charge the jury on Thursday and have them, you know, start deliberations under the shadow of a 3-day weekend. My guess is they're going to aim to trying to get to the case of the jury on Wednesday at the latest.
Well, then I guess we're going to see. Do you believe Raul Valley will take the stand at any point?
It's really hard to make that assessment without knowing more of the evidence, but it would surprise me.
It would surprise you if he did.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that have him there, and could he testify on a self-defense issue? Sure, he could. And, you know, at the end of the day, because he was a juvenile at the time, his ultimate sentence is there's not as much variation in what can happen because anybody who's convicted of an offense and gets over 10 years is eligible for early parole.
Even though he's being charged as an adult? Because didn't he get moved to an adult? Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, because there's a law was passed in 2015 that says that if you were under 18 at the time, even if you're charged with an adult, if you're sentenced you're eligible for parole after 60% of your sentence if you get over 12 years, but also if you get over 30 years, you're eligible after 50% of your sentence. So I know the paper said he was offered a 40-year plea bargain.
He didn't take it.
He didn't take it. Now, he would have been eligible for parole after 24 years on that. If the maximum on this is 60, he would be eligible for parole after 30 years if he received the maximum. And if he's convicted, again, I want to stress that I'm not saying he should be convicted. I'm not saying he's going to be convicted. But, you know, if he's convicted, there is not quite as much play the range is not as wide as it might be in an adult court. Keeping in mind when I say he could be parole eligible, that doesn't mean he's going to get parole. That depends on a lot of things, including, you know, any kind of behavior. How the parole board at the time is constituted. So, you know, I would expect it to conclude this week, but maybe he testifies on us to answer your question. You know, maybe there is a self-defense claim and he says he was trying to protect one of his friends. That's not implausible. And that may be something his lawyer's weighing.
Yeah, I guess we're going to see. Attorney Bloss, again, not involved with the case, but our legal expert on the show. We always appreciate these conversations. Thank you so much.